No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. And I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight, we have a special guest, but first, let me introduce my co-host, Maria. How are you doing out there in L.A., Maria? Staying safe, I hope.
Yeah, Los Angeles has half of the cases of the entire state, Los Angeles County. So we're staying super vigilant, and I'm sheltering in place since the beginning of March. So it's more of the same, but it's terrible. It's just terrible.
Yeah, that's what we hear out here. And everybody, I hope everybody out there is staying safe and listening to us instead of running around outside drinking and doing other things that is going to spread this virus. It's really right. Horrible. But right. Tonight we have a special guest. We have Hillary O. Shelton, who's the director of the NAACP here in Washington. It's Washington Bureau. And he's the senior vice president for policy and advocacy, and we're going to get him on the show right away. I would read his resume to you, but that would take the entire show. He's quite an accomplished gentleman, and it's so nice that he's with us tonight. Mr. Shelton, are you there?
Yes, I am, and just an honor to be with you tonight.
Well, it's great to have you. And let me start out by asking you this question. The NAACP is one of the oldest, most respected civil rights organizations in America. And we see this new movement with the Black Lives Matter. And it really appears to me, anyway, that they're making great progress. What's your take on all this? Do you think we're making great progress? Is there tangible change on the way, or is this just window dressing to change the Mississippi flag and the NASCAR thing and changing the name of the Redskins? But are we seeing real, you think we're going to see real change out of this?
I do very much so. As a matter of fact, it's great to see what our young people are doing under the guise in the Black Lives Matter movement. It was come to be recognized by the NAACP and civil rights organizations, whether they're still working or whether they're not working anymore, is that those that recognize that the fight that's going on for change in our country to address racial, ethnic, LGBT, and other forms of discrimination, of course, gender discrimination, is very much a part of the landscape. It has to be a fight that's one that is first nonviolent and rooted in the kind of high-level priority for all Americans, recognizing that it's crucial to even the constitutional promises of our country of equal protection and equal opportunity under law, that it's going to take a movement. I love one of the chants I see our young people doing sometimes. They're marching in our streets or holding rallies and pointing that bright light, showing where the problems are and where the real contradictions are in our nation to try to make those changes. But the chant you hear from them sometimes is, it's not about this moment, it's about a movement. That is the interconnection of the challenge and the problems that so many people in our country still have in the United States, and how so much of that is rooted in the isms and schisms like racism and sexism and anti-Semitism and anti-Arabism and all the other challenges that we have a tendency to see and hear. But they recognize it, and they're responding to it. they're responding to with a forward movement to shine that bright light on it so that we can move to fix the problem. What I love is that they're owning the issues. We have a saying at the NAACP as well, in order to fix these problems, you've got to first own them. You've got to claim them. You know, when we have a problem with the president of the United States, well, it's our country too. It's our White House. It's our president. We've got a problem with the person that's in there now, and we've got to fix it. So we claim it so that we can work on it and point out that indeed what he's doing is wrong when what he's doing is wrong. So all that being said, I'm proud of the young people across the country, whether they're in Ferguson, Missouri, right next to my hometown of St. Louis, a place where I grew up and spent much of my misspent youth, or whether they're working in New York, focusing in on what happened for Eric Garner, or wherever the challenges are across the country under that movement, we're seeing them focusing the attention in a very disciplined way, raising the issues. But also one of the things they're demonstrating is that this is not just a black movement. This is an American movement that ties in people of all different races, ethnicities, and other challenges. That is, if you look at what's going on, what you see is those who are marching look like America. They are African-American and white. They are Native American, Hispanic, Asian Americans, and all the wonderful blends in between. But what they share is a common focus. That is, that focus is that what's going on now is not right. It has to be changed. We've got to fix it for this moment, but we also have to see this as part of a movement to fix it forever. That we have when we're talking about police, it's not just an anomaly, it's a pattern in practice. When we're talking about economic disparities and other challenges, the same thing applies when we're talking about unemployment, business ownership, housing, health care, whatever the issues are, from our criminal justice system to our education system, that the issue is that we have to have high quality, whatever it is, for all Americans, regardless of our differences. And I love to see what they're doing. I happen to have three sons, and my middle son was in college in New York and had to come back. But since he's been back, in addition to finishing up his classes online, he's out there marching and demonstrating, of course, exercising the importance of distancing and caution by wearing his mask and even rubber gloves when he needs to. But he's there to make sure that his voice is heard and they're saying that the problem that's going on isn't just focused on a segment of the population, but it's an American problem that affects all of us. So I'm very proud of our Black Lives Matter people.
Yeah, I think you're right. And before I let Maria ask a question, let me just say, I know how you feel about your son because I've got my two daughters who are also out there doing the same thing. And I'm amazed by it, you know, by the kids that I had to tell to clean up the room 375 times, and then they never actually did it, you know, that they're out there marching and they're out there on social media. So that's great. Go ahead, Maria. I don't want to monopolize the time.
Thank you. Mr. Shelton, first of all, thank you for taking the time to visit with us on our program and for that eloquent statement that you made, because you framed it beautifully. And I'm curious, since the NAACP was founded in 1909, and mm-hmm. we're having many of the conversations that created the start of it today, I was heartened to hear that you think that this is different than it's been, because that's over 100 years that the NAACP is trying to get the equality and the justice and all of that sort of thing. So I wanted to ask, since you have 500,000 members, how can we help with the outreach in getting our listeners to become members?
Well, they should definitely join. Like any other movement, and when we're talking about a movement like this, this is one that starts at the grassroots, but it's one that's quite international. It's W.B. Du Bois established, as you know, really one of our most well-known and original Pan-Africanists, the interconnection between the challenges and the struggles all over the country and throughout the world. So with our women, men, and everyone else, we'd love them to join the NAACP, to be actively engaged. We are as effective as the members that are actively engaged on the ground, at the state level, and at the federal level as well. So indeed, we'd love to have them join. They can actually go to our website at naacp.org and get the information to sign up. They can also find out where their closest unit is. We have 2,200 membership units throughout the country with units in every state in the United States, from small towns to large cities. We would love them to become actually involved where they are. As the saying goes, all politics really is local. Making sure that as we look at how our governmental system works, the oversight and so forth, we're talking about the government that is our local government and being actively engaged there. We want to make sure that our state governments have so much power that people don't realize as we look at the federal government that we're really a federalist society. That is, states' rights. Unfortunately, in so many cases, it's still the structure and law of the land. So we need them involved. We want them involved. Regardless of their race, gender, ethnicity, or other differences, we want them as an active member of the NAACP. And if not a member of our organization directly, then involved in some organization that we can work with in a coalition structure. You may also know an interesting background. The NAACP is one of the three founding members of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the United States' oldest and largest civil rights coalition, with over 200 organizations, from direct civil rights organizations like the NAACP, the National Urban League, the National Council of Negro Women, and others of those who are part of the first of civil rights organizations, to labor unions. Women's organizations, LGBT community organizations, Latino organizations, LULAC, National Council of Rosa, that's now called Unidos US, are all members of that coalition as well. So we want them involved in one way or another. The only way we can win this fight is if we have all hands on deck, regardless of what you come to that deck looking like, thinking like, and what your experiences are before. Last point I'll make on that is we learned some tough lessons along the way as you invoke Black Lives Matter and the NAACP. That is that we know that we have different organizations that represent different entities of people living in the United States, that they're all here to make sure they can get the promise of America. That is, they want to make sure they can educate their children to be able to go as far as their minds will take them instead of just their mom and daddy's pocketbook. Making sure that women are protected and able to fully participate without discrimination and the isms that too often go along with being a woman, a female, living in the United States of America. And then we talk about the racial and ethnic groups and other differences, including labor and so forth. So the bottom line is that in my own long-winded way, we need them, we want them, we hope we can find some way to work together and recognize what we refer to oftentimes as that convergence in interest. It can be capitalized or kind of summarized in that saying that we may have all come here in different boats, but we're on the same ship now. And if it goes down, we're all going down. So let me stop there.
And that it's reasonable. It's $30 for a year if you're an adult.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Yes. Yes. Can you go to meetings?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Okay. Listen, once you join the organization, that's why I recommend that they go online, NAACP.org, find their closest unit, the local unit. They will be tied in each of the other two areas as well. So your local unit is looking at what's going on right there on the ground, and that's the day-to-day. But you're also engaged in not only focused on your city, town, hamlet, village, whatever the case might be, but you're focused on your state. Because we know that's where the power is as well. That's where decisions are made all the time. If we're thinking about education, there is a state education entity with one name or the other that oversees in many ways what happens, how teachers are certified and otherwise throughout the entire state. So we need you plugged in there, knowing that that's where changes are and that's a governmental structure that has a tremendous effect on even things like use of force in police officers is something that in many states is actually set and trained by a state policing entity that actually sets the criterion and curriculum for our police academies across the country. So the fight in many ways is at the local level, but part of that fight when we think about police brutality issues is also at the state level too. And then finally, of course, what happens at the federal level, and that is the resources that come in to make up the differences for anything from education to health care, to finance issues, mortgages, being able to protect you from predatory lenders. Those issues are set at the federal level as well. So that active engagement with the NAACP begins at that local level. And so we hope that people will see that that becomes not only a place where you're spending that $30 a year to support the organization, but a place where you are actively engaged at that level, hopefully participating in one of the in one of the groups that are part of the NAACP. That is, as you think about the sections of the NAACP, if education is where your passion is, there's an education committee of every branch that's focusing on those issues at the local level and beyond. If healthcare is your passion, there's a health committee in each NAACP unit that's doing the same thing. If economic development issues, small business, job coordination, and other issues along lines, if that's where your passion is, then we have a committee that focuses on those issues as well. If criminal justice is your passion, if you're worried about the death penalty still being a part of the American landscape as races and classes, as the death penalty has been administered in the United States, and you want to do something about it, that criminal justice committee of your local branch working with your state conference of branches, which is how the branches connect together to impact what's happening at the state level to the broader issues of the national organization, in which all of those state conferences are plugged in together as well under what we call a regional structure. That's all for the purposes of organizing, but making sure we have hands on deck to get the work done is what is most crucial for us.
Well, you know, I need to ask you, Mr. Shelton, because this is something that I'm sensing, and I'm not sure if you're sensing it too, but the thing that surprises me really about this movement is that people seem to be more receptive than they've ever been in the past. You know, when you talk about education, for example, it has always troubled me here in Washington, D.C., that we are the single most well-educated city in America. More people have graduate degrees in Washington, D.C. than any other city. But when you go into Ward 8, when I first was elected 14 years ago, 51% of the kids at Anacostia High School did not graduate on time. And, you know, and it used to trouble me that here we are, you know, in this city where we are so privileged, but we still have a high school, a major high school, big high school, where it's more likely that you won't graduate than that you will. So these are issues that have been out there for a long time. But it seems to me that for now, for some reason, we're all more receptive to this. Are you seeing that? Do you feel that?
I think so. I think there are a number of things that have played a very helpful role in Americans being able to see what's happening with their brothers and sisters that came to this country, or the descendants of those that came to this country in different ways. By that I mean, if from healthcare, from education to criminal justice, most people didn't realize just how bad it was on the other side of town, and most people had known just how bad some of those schools were. That he had a school on one side of town that had the most up-to-date technology, small classroom sizes, and other things to provide an assistance to making sure you get a high-quality education. And then on the other side of town, you can't find a place to plug in a computer. You know, those issues raise some concerns for us as well. And, of course, like too many other things, we've seen, and D.C.'s gotten beyond a lot of this, in my opinion, but, for instance, my hometown of St. Louis, on one side of town, you see that either the public schools themselves are funded quite differently. We still have a challenge with how those schools are funded. D.C. has worked this out. D.C.'s system is one that they don't do an assessment of resources made available to a public school using what they call polygrids. That is, the amount of resources that are coming in to create a revenue to pay for our public schools would come only from the community in which that school was located. I'm talking St. Louis now, not D.C.
Yeah.
What that means is, it's like most people, you live in the side of town that you can afford. If you're poor and can't afford living in the nice section of town, and the way they're paying for our public schools is through tax revenue based on the value of the homes in an area, if you're in an area where more people rent, where the property values are lower, then there are fewer resources to pay for that education program. If you're in a side of town where you have upper middle class people and beyond living in the homes are valued at a higher price. That means that the taxes on those homes are going to be higher. That means that there's more revenue, more resources to be able to spend for those schools as well. D.C. learned that lesson, and that's why it doesn't matter what side of town you're on. We allocate the same amount of money per student in our public schools regardless, and we're seeing improvement as a result of that. The other side of the equation, again, if I go to my hometown, what I see is on one side of town, they're trying to figure out how to keep the doors open. And on the other side of town, they've got all the highest level of technologies, the newest programs, and they're able to give our kids what they need and the kind of attention, most importantly, they need as well, because you end up with a ratio of one teacher to 16 students, as opposed to, sadly, when I was growing up, we had one teacher and 45 students in the same class in a public school in the African-American side of town, trying to figure out how to make sure everybody got what they needed and nobody got left out. So you're absolutely right. D.C.'s learned some lessons, implemented, not perfect, but moving in the right direction to do the right thing.
Could I ask Mr. Shelton about possible civil rights violations during the coronavirus pandemic? Are you seeing, are you hearing stories about that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The challenges are, again, as we go into poor areas, there are less resources available to be able to provide what the CDC and other healthcare entities are saying we need. Look, when we talk about how many kids we can actually put in that classroom, we have to make sure that we have a classroom that can accommodate that smaller group, that the protections are all in place. But what we're saying is that kids being forced back into schools, or trying to force kids back into schools now without the protections, without the preparation. If there's anything that is a civil rights violation, it's a threat to one's health and ability. For those of us who've seen what it looks like when someone contracts coronavirus 19, for those who have seen the impact of, even after it is considered to have passed, the damage that is left and the fewer abilities that that person has to be able to fully participate, whether it's in education or other things and whatnot, even jobs for that matter, then we recognize that we can't do it this way. For some reason, we have a president that seems to be quite willing to violate that basic equal protection under law and not allow everyone to be able to be protected as we move ahead to talk about opening things. We've got a problem. We have a problem because nothing has really changed. That is, when we began shutting things down and all clustering at home and whatnot, we started seeing a decrease in the spread of coronavirus. But then we saw over the Memorial Day holiday weekend, beaches opening too soon. We saw our young people gathered in a way that they were allowed to be right next to each other at like spring break in any other year before this, where you were not worried about such a contagious disease moving around as coronavirus is. So the short of it is, we are seeing those problems. And sadly, the numbers are showing it as well. When we look at who's affected, we know that African Americans are three times more likely to be those that have contracted coronavirus than white Americans. Mm-hmm. How is that? When we look at those disparities, we know they're there, but for some reason, the policies and strategies are not reflecting that problem. And that is certainly a civil rights violation as well. So you're right. We've got a big problem there. We are trying to push these things through. We're working very closely with our friends on Capitol Hill, whether it's Congressional Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, the Asian American Caucus, the Progressive Caucus, the Women's Caucus. They get it. And they are working with us to try to address it. But then we have those who seem to be more driven by being able to get back to maximizing a profit, even at the behest of the lives and livelihoods of so many Americans in this country. We just can't allow it. Our democratic structure should not let us allow it. And we have to continue to do what we see our young people doing, going back to the first question we were talking about in Black Lives Matter. Being out there demonstrating, pointing the finger at the issues, and working out the real strategies and problems. We have a bill right now, as you probably know, that passed the House that would allocate an additional over $3 trillion to address many of these issues and concerns that we're discussing now. It passed the House. It's sitting in the Senate. As a matter of fact, to a point that we're starting to refer to how Mitch McConnell, the majority leader of the Senate, is not managing these issues as bills are coming from the House then as Mitch's graveyard. So what we have now is a piece of legislation to provide many of the resources to address the very problems, the very civil rights problems that we're discussing right now. It's not being utilized and not being followed through.
And may I mention, one second, Michael, that you as an organization, if people feel like they have been violated with their civil rights, that you want to know about that via your website so that you can follow up on that.
Absolutely. On our website at NAACP.org, reporting that information to your local unit. We have an extraordinary NAACP local unit here in Washington, D.C., that's been doing a wonderful job for a very, very long time. Akoshua Tyus Ali is our branch president here in D.C. So people in D.C. want to report what's going on. Her branch wants to know about it. They're collecting that information, and they're sharing it with the national organization so we have it organized at a national level as well. Again, so we know what's going on in D.C. in many, many cases is not very different than what's going on in Chicago or what's going in other places. Or if we see that one place is doing it better than another, then we want to make sure we have that. We have those prototypes to be able to show to others so we can work to fix those problems in other parts of the country as well.
Nice.
Let me ask you, since the subject has come up, how much of, you know, one thing that I see that's different, Mr. Shelton, is that corporate America is responding to this. You know, you've got FedEx saying they're going to take the, you know, they want the name of the Redskins change. You've got NASCAR taking down the Stars and Bars. You've got, you know, other corporations responding to the fact, I guess, that Black people are big consumers, they're putting pressure on corporate America. How much do you think of this political capital that's now being spent is a result of what people like you and your organization have done over the last 50 years? That now, you know, I can't see NASCAR 10 years ago taking down the Stars and Bars. Can you?
I couldn't have. As a matter of fact, it seemed like it was part of the landscape. You could not watch a car race on television under NASCAR where you did not see the Stars and Bars flying somewhere or even painted on the sides of some of those race cars. Yeah. So the point you're making is right on target. It's great to see corporate America stepping up the way it has. Whether it's our friends, as you mentioned, Pepsi-Cola's done a wonderful job thinking about what's going on with sports along with a number of other friends in that area. Whether we're thinking about what's going on here with even Verizon and AT&T and Comcast has stepped up and are helping out with other corporate friends as well. There's value in our corporate in our corporations showing how important these issues are by putting not only their voices in the mix, but also their resources too. Now, we still have some that are not. There are a few that we're going to have to work to address some of these problems with and whatnot. They haven't stepped in. I don't know if some of them are too shy and are fearful that they'll get a blow from the other side they step in and raise these issues along those lines. But our hope is that we can get more and more of them engaged. The examples that are shown are examples that I know how I feel personally about how I spend my money. I want to spend my money with people that share my values. I think business is something that is reciprocal. And if I'm doing business with my friends at Verizon, I want to know that they'll step up and raise issues about, you know, one of the things we've partnered with them on is prison phone rates. They've actually called for prisons to reduce those phone rates. And actually, they got out of the phone rate business in prisons because they were saying that when we were doing this, there was so much corruption and how we had to set our rates to pay off many along the ways that we stopped doing it. And what happened with most big prisons across the country is they set up their own telephone companies and are maximizing their profits, sadly, in a way that doesn't recognize who those people are in those cells. And that over 85% of them were at or below the poverty line at the time they went in the first place. and being able to afford phone rates that looked more like one of those late night on TV advertised dating services was impossible for them to start out with a call that would cost over $4 for the first minute. And then that kind of a cost beyond that. But our friends in the corporate community stepped forward. They helped us make those changes and whatnot, going after those others that were trying to really take advantage of so many Americans, even as we recognize that if we're thinking about our prisons, changing stuff as an example for just a minute, we know that those who maintain close contact with their families and local community while they're in prison are much less likely to go back to prison and reduce the recidivism rate along the way. So it's a big deal. And again, as we're thinking about coronavirus in that broad sweeping way in which it's functioning, along with so many other problems we had before coronavirus hit the forefront, by the way, we have to make sure that we're, again, celebrating our friends that are stepping forward in the corporate community and pushing others to step forward as well. What we're learning with coronavirus is that it doesn't matter what part of the country you live in. It doesn't matter your gender or race or ethnicity. It doesn't matter what country your forefathers and mothers came from. None of that matters. Regardless of that, you can contract it and you can die.
Well, let me ask you, this is a problem that I have as a former political PR person. When we talk about defunding the police, I assume that the legislation you're referring to is the BREATHE Act.
Yeah.
That you passed in the House. Well, it reduces, you know, it's really, really wide ranging, right? Reduces DOD budget, does things on, establishes public safety offices, does all sorts of things to revamp the system, especially the political system, the policing system. What do you think about defunding the police? The problem that I have with that is I understand the concept and I support it, but the language they use, it worries me that it's going to scare some people. You know, here in D.C., we've had nearly 100 people slain this year. We've had 16 dead in the first 10 days of July, including one of the most heartbreaking stories that I've ever heard, a little boy named Devon McNeil, who was 11 years old, who was killed at a barbecue that his mother had organized because she's a person that is a violence intervener and works with gangs, and she had organized a July 4th, let's all get together and be friends, barbecue, and this little boy was murdered when a couple of gangbangers started shooting at each other. So what do you think? You think we should be using different language, or how do you feel about that?
Well, look, I've heard that language been used, but as I hear people describe the reasons that they're calling for a defunding of the police, it's what they seem to be saying is, we got to start over. And what we have is a system that's really gotten out of control to a point that some people don't want to call the police when suspicious activity is going around their homes because they're fearful that they'll come in and actually will create more problems. If people end up dead when what was really needed is someone to come and say, look, you guys are going to have to slow down and stop this stuff and go home, it turns into something altogether different. So I do appreciate the need to do a comprehensive reassessment of law enforcement, including policing in the United States. You may remember some years ago, Senator Webb from Virginia introduced a bill to totally reassess our criminal justice system and how policing works. For some reason, our view and reality of policing in the United States looks very militaristic. It looks like you can't tell the difference between sometimes the police in some of our communities and a military action in the Middle East. It seems to look the same. So there's a real problem when we seem to have declared war on each other, and we're bringing military-clad police officers in with their stormtrooper helmets and everything else, not in a way that they're part of the community, but they're coming in a way in which they're there to actually control the community. We need to look at that and see about some changes. Why is it that we have more weapons and more often deadly force is utilized by police officers on our streets? Why is it that we're using Michael Brown as an example in Ferguson, Missouri? Though that 6'4" tall police officer also had pepper spray and his taser on his gun belt, it was his pistol that he pulled out and started shooting Michael Brown to death in a way that made no sense, particularly when it came to mind that Michael Brown was unarmed. That Michael Brown was scheduled to start college at the University of Missouri in St. Louis the very next week. And even as much as he may have had whatever personality he did, that should not have been a death sentence. And in essence, that's what was. And if you listen to what Dan Wilson, the police officer in that particular case, said to the grand jury when they asked him about it, he said that he was afraid. Now, Michael Brown is about a 6-foot-tall African-American male, but Dan Wilson, the police officer, was 6'4" and had a shotgun in the console between his seats in his car. He had his police-issued gun, and he also, again, had a taser, a nightstick, and other things, and what he was addressing was an unarmed African-American. When he described what he felt, Officer Wilson said he felt fear for his life because when he looked into Michael Brown's eyes, it didn't appear that he had a life or a soul. Go back and read the transcripts from that case, and you'll see how outrageous that part of it was, as if he was casually discussing those issues with the grand jurors themselves. Point is, I understand why they're raising the issue about wanting to defund them, because so many of the things we're seeing that our tax dollars seem to be paying for, when we're seeing these awful cases across our country, we should not be spending a dime on. As a matter of fact, our resources should be spent to prevent these incidents from ever happening at all. So we need major change. We're very happy with a piece of legislation that just passed the House, the George Floyd bill that's now pending in the Senate. We believe it'll make a tremendous difference. We need to set our policies for the acceptable use of force, what you can and cannot do under which circumstances. We need to set our policy for how we make sure we provide some accountability of police officers by the citizens themselves. The police cannot police themselves. I appreciate internal affairs and its responsibilities. We still need that. But beyond that, we also need police accountability review boards, much like the one that used to be active in D.C. that was defunded. So in essence, we need some change to happen. It must be comprehensive change to address a comprehensive problem with law enforcement in the streets and throughout the cities of America.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say the thing about people not wanting to call the police. I was involved in a crime on Capitol Hill where I called the police, and they ended up arresting a guy and disarming him. He had a weapon, and when they arrested him, they found out that he had been to 5 other houses, and nobody called the police. And the police officer was just stunned by that. They said, in one case, the guy tried to force his way into the house, and the woman leaned up against the door and was able to close the door quick enough so he couldn't get in. And the police officer just couldn't believe that after that, she didn't call the police. So there's a lot of truth to that, and there's a lot of change that needs to come.
Absolutely. Listen, on that issue, I've been in the position and honored to bet every attorney general of the United States that we've had going back to Janet Reno under the Clinton administration. And regardless of whether they were appointed by a Democrat or a Republican, when we began talking about issues like use of force, racial profiling, and all those things, I'll begin with Janet Reno because they all said it in their own way but said the same thing. They said, Hillary, look, we've got to pass anti-racial profiling legislation, and we've got to pass legislation to address issues of the misuse of force. Because as things are now, we do not have the necessary trust and perception of integrity between American citizens and others on our streets and the police officers that are supposed to be there to serve them. If you don't have that trust and integrity, you cannot prevent crimes from happening, because nobody will talk to the police or others. Because if you have that problem, you also never get these crimes solved. Because again, no one will trust police officers or other forms of law enforcement to make sure that they have the kind of testimony and evidence that they need to address these problems. You're absolutely right in that we've got to fix this issue by making sure we can restore that trust and that sense of integrity. We know that in too often in too many places, the police officer in one neighborhood is officer friendly, and in the other neighborhood, he's an occupying force.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go ahead, Maria.
I was going to say, because our listeners are active individuals, they're passionate, they care, because there's opportunities that you touched on briefly earlier in the program about volunteering, could you share how one would go about if they want to volunteer for the NAACP? And also, might that involve getting registering voters?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned, all the other committees that are active, the way we organize and structure our engagement to try to repair these problems and address these issues in our communities, we need people involved at every level. So that means that we want you to go online at NAACP.org. We want you to find the unit that you in the area that you live in. If you live in D.C., the Washington, D.C. branch of the NAACP. Montgomery County has a branch. Alexandria, Virginia has a branch, and on and on and on. But contact the branch. Those branch meetings happen regularly. The committees within those branches that are trying to solve these problems at various levels meet very often as well. Whatever your passion is, education, health care, criminal justice, housing, economic development, whatever your passion is, there's a committee for it. We want you to bring your talents, your energies, and resources to bear to help us organize to be able to fix these problems. But the bottom line is that we live in a democratic society. That is, of the people, by the people, and for the people. But the people that win are those that are organized. Utilizing the NAACP as that organized structure to address that problem that is part of your passion is something that we look forward to. So go online. The contact information will be there for the unit that's closest to you. If you have young people on this call as well, we have a very active youth and college division of the NAACP as well, with college chapters on every university and college in the District of Columbia. And then many, many beyond that. I believe we have over 400 college chapters throughout the country. So for our young people, a good place to be involved. Our youth work committees, for those who are not in college yet but still want to be actively involved with the NAACP, is managed through those local units as well. But we want you to come be there with us. Help us come up with the best solutions. And then help us strategize for ways to deploy our energies to make those changes and address those problems. Those solutions are with us. We just have to be organized in a way that we can bring them into a reality.
Well, now Maria has unleashed the 800-pound gorilla in the room by saying voting. As you well know, Mr. Shelton, the people of the District of Columbia do not have a representative in either House of Congress that can vote, and you. I have to say thank you very much to the NAACP, because right after we passed H.R. 51, you reached out to your membership and encouraged them to contact their senators to pass 621, which is our companion legislation in the Senate. Since you're so experienced and an eloquent spokesman, do you have any advice for us on what we need to do? Because we know getting those 60 votes in the Senate, my office is now working with Republicans trying to move them, but you understand how hard that is. And to get those 60 votes in the Senate is going to take pressure from the outside. So any advice on what we can do to do a better job at trying to get the legislation passed?
Let me first say you've been doing an extraordinary job, especially if you think about, again, how our government is structured. When I say extraordinary, it's because D.C. has no votes, which means that some of the capital that you usually have in the political circle to be able to make these things happen, we're at a disadvantage in D.C. I live here in D.C. as well. Yeah. We were able to get the House to see it and understand it after years and years of educating those members of the House outside. It means that more of our national groups are going to have to do what the NAACP has done. We've passed and reaffirmed our policy position supporting full statehood rights for the people of Washington, D.C., going back for decades now. And we continue to believe that needs to be done. But we know the way the government decisions are made, and right now it's going to be state by state. We're going to have to find ways to make sure that those in those states see where it's actually of value to them, that the people of Washington, D.C. are treated like Americans throughout the country, that the people of Washington, D.C. have died in as many or more wars, pay as much or more tax. We know the whole story here, but they need to understand it as well. And we're thinking about them being disenfranchised, not having that full voice. Let me say, you've done a great job, but quite frankly, we haven't fully given you the job yet.
Yeah.
When we think about Eleanor Holmes Norton, she's done an extraordinary job in the House of Representatives.
Extraordinary.
But all she can use is her voice because she doesn't have a vote on the floor. So the bottom line is we're going to have to make sure that people understand all over the country. Let me say this as well, and I think you've heard this too. Most people across the United States, when you share it with them that the people of Washington, D.C. do not have full voting rights, they look at you perplexed. They had no idea.
That's right.
They didn't know it was like that. And so in
the ignorance is tremendous. I'm sorry.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm just stunned at
that
how much
level of education
people don't know.
Is very, very important. I love some of the commercials I've seen on TV, on CNN, and a couple other places, and that begins to really scratch at the surface of expanding the message outside of the borders of the District of Columbia. We're going to have to continue to do that. We have to utilize the tools that we have in our various media outlets. Let me just say, you were asking about Black Lives Matter a little bit earlier and why they've been so successful in moving forward. I will say that because they are, in addition to being an outgrowth of those that are outraged at what's going on in our country, they're also a generation that is more tech savvy than any other time in the history of our country. When else can you point to a time when you had in your pocket something that would allow you to video things going on, whether they are great things you could celebrate, of the tragic things that unfortunately we needed to uncover for Americans to see? Let me make this point just real quick, and I want to get back to it before we run out of time. You know, we saw a turn in America responding to some of the ugly secrets in our country that had not been uncovered. And that is, we go back to Rodney King in the very early 90s. When they began saying that this man was nearly beaten to death by police officers, people had all kind of said, no, that couldn't be the case. You know, I know Officer Friendly, he's great, whatnot, hands out lollipops to the kids on the schoolyard and all that kind of stuff. What they didn't realize is there's another face to an Officer Friendly in which they would get in hot pursuit with an African-American man in a car. And when he pulled over, they would take him out. If you can look at the video even today, it looked to me like they were trying to beat that man to death, but that a white bystander standing on his balcony with a new toy that he'd bought, a video camera, was playing with the video camera, saw what was going on, and filmed the entire thing. Let me just say, when America saw what had happened there, they turned out in numbers. Unfortunately, we had too much violence in that process that distracted from actually fixing the problem, but it still pointed to the issue that we now saw what was going on. I say that the reason we're seeing our Black Lives Matter friends turning out the way that they are in such big numbers and such racially and ethnically, gender and otherwise diverse numbers is because now we're all looking at the same information. Now we're all seeing just how awful it is. We're all thinking that only by the grace of God go I, did you see what they did to that woman? Did you see what they did to that man? Did you see what they did to that 12-year-old kid playing on the playground in Cleveland, Ohio? In other words, the story is out there. We're getting it more than ever. Being able to share that outside of the district walls, the district borders, making sure people know exactly what's going on, being able to see the video clips and other information, I think is just the tool that we're going to need to be able to turn this country around and make sure that the people of D.C. have full voting rights as well.
Well, I think that's so important to what you said, because I think this movement that's been ignited by the murder of George Floyd, we all saw a lynching there. You know, I've heard many people call it a lynching. We saw this man who was helpless on the ground. We saw the indifference in the police officer's face. It was a horrible, horrible thing to watch. And I think you're right about our ability to now record things and get them out there. But we've only got a minute left. So is there anything that we haven't asked you, Mr. Shelton, that you want to say in closing?
Well, let me just say first, this has been wonderful for me. I've had a great time on this Sunday evening this conversation with you. You guys are great. You've asked the good questions, the open-ended questions, so we could have the kind of conversation that we've had. So I can't point to any particular question, but just to reaffirm how important it is for us all to be involved, that this is not a spectator sport, that what we're looking at is what democracy really is all about, and the only way it's going to work for all of us is if all of us are involved, whether we're the ones that are taking the beating or the ones that just happen to see the video footage that that some kid was able to take utilizing their cell phone from behind a tree. The bottom line is that the fight is on and nobody can be left out of it. There's no way you can run from it. You can't run that fast. There's no way you can hide from it. The bright light will find you and the challenges will be there. And you'll be looking at these problems saying, well, only by the grace of God go I, and recognizing just how true that is. So no more questions. You guys are all the great ones. My final response is I hope everyone will be involved. Register a voter somewhere and make sure everybody's prepared to participate in this upcoming election, among other things.
Yes, to register to vote and then to vote and make sure that everyone that you know is registered to vote and votes.
Absolutely.
And after the election, we'll have you back and we'll talk some more, I hope, because this is certainly an ongoing process. And, you know, every week we leave our listeners with a song usually dedicated to our guest. And tonight I picked the Morehouse College rendition of We Shall Overcome because it's a very solemn rendition of a very solemn song, and I think, you know, as Mr. Shelton so eloquently pointed out, we're all in this together, and we need to stop and think and move together so that we can move our country forward. Thank you so much for listening, and Maria, I give you the final word.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Shelton, for what you do, and you're so very eloquent. We always like to thank our listeners, because if it weren't for you, we wouldn't have the broadcast. And we want to thank you for making us a priority in your life, whether you listen live or you download on demand. And it's with your good grace that we're able to do what we're doing.
Give the people their right to vote.